You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producers Flo and Liam. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, for Dear Science this week, our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern, speaks with us about scientists using humour, sea slug colours, and wound-healing imaging. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the rise in fuel prices, what we can expect from the government in terms of support, and how that fits into the cost of living crisis. I also spoke with the head of brand and communications at MOTAT, Samantha Perry, about the MOTAT STEM Fair, why it's important, and what it means in the wider context of MOTAT's goals. Flo, what have you got for us today?
Kia ora and thank you, Alex. I spoke to Richard Jackson, leading thinker, chair in peace and conflict studies at the University of Otago, about the war in Iran, chances for peace, and the long-term effects on regional stability and the international community.
He aha au o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or Waiamai Rani, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Koua e ware ware, e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero ānau, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora. Kia ora.
Kushla, what have you got for us today?
So an interesting assortment today, starting with funny scientists, which some might say is a bit of an oxymoron, because scientists, we're not really known for our humour. But, you know, humour is actually a really powerful tool for making a message memorable, right? And so we perhaps underuse it in science communication, particularly at like conferences where experts in a field are talking to other experts. And so this is what this study was about. So we know that humour is good for getting a message across. Like, there's been surveys of TED Talks. So they looked at about 2,000 TED Talks and found that the most popular presenters used humour 3 times more. So we remember a talk, we enjoy it when we get a laugh. So what this team did was they were a team of ecologists, people who study evolution and conservation, and so they attended 14 conferences, and across this they scored 531 talks. But it was like each person wasn't going to all 14 talks, conferences, so each talk was scored by a single person. So you have to caveat that, right? Because what I think is a joke might not be what you think is a joke, kind of thing. And 531 talks, there were 870 unique jokes. Most people weren't making any jokes whatsoever. So about 42%. So yeah, some conferences are a bit hard going. And when they did make a joke, it was largely improvised. So it was about a tech failure or something that was happening in the situation, right? So someone stumbling in late or something like this. So they weren't pre-panned. There were about 20% of jokes were subject related. So it was about, you know, being out in the field or, you know, just in the lab and stuff. Only 6% actually had any pop cultural reference. And most of them were spoken. They weren't really doing physical comedy. They weren't really using their slides for visual sort of jokes or anything. So what is kind of funny, not funny, is that 9% of the jokes got the whole room laughing. Most of them were falling absolutely flat. Or people did the polite chuckle. You know when you get really embarrassed with someone and so you go, yeah, oh, really? So... So nightmare. Scientists, not so funny. And they also were like, there's a little bit of a, maybe a social dynamics, demographic sort of thing going on where males were slightly more prone to giving a joke in more senior sort of males. So like if you were young and not a native English speaker, you were probably less likely to give a joke, but also it was less likely to be laughed at. So yeah, we maybe need to inject some humor in some of these things. These authors, though, you could see that they'd really, I suspect that they went, we want to write a paper where we can write lots of jokes and be quite jovial in it. And in the reviewers' comments, this was actually one of the things where they were like, oh, this is making a few jokes, but it kind of fits with this paper. And my favorite line was, why do so many scientific talks have the energy of a sedated sloth? So, yep.
And it shines through. Look, I've watched TED Talks in my day, and they are regrettably all ones that I find funny. I feel a little bit caught out.
Yeah, no, but it's our natural instinct, right? Yeah. If we have a laugh, we feel good. We kind of remember it, and so it is this thing of, you know, we kind of need to remember that using humor to get a message across is quite effective, and not being super serious all the time. Yeah,
always good to keep it fun.
Yeah,
you know, we like fun, but. Awesome. Well, yeah. Interesting.
So the next topic is really fun, though.
Yeah.
And one of the best names, nudibranchs. So these are soft-bodied marine gastropod mollusks. So what this means, soft body, basically after the larval stage, they lose their shell. Gastropods, this means they're slugs or snails. This is the grouping they're in. Mollusks is a kind of a larger grouping where it's their above the gastropods, so they're slugs, snails, squid, cuttlefish, marine, they're living in shallow waters. So soft body marine gastropod mollusks, why are these interesting? They are awesome colors. Like, look them up online, you'll see they're all odd shapes, they're like really bright colors, they've got patterns on them. And this is actually where we're talking about this before, Pikachu nudibranch. Look it up. It's very cute. It's very cool. This is where scientists do show the humor, and where they do make pop cultural references is when they name species.
And it does look like Pikachu.
Can confirm.
But, okay, so why are we... So they do call them the butterflies of the sea because of this vast array of colors and shapes and stuff. Why are we interested in it today? Is because we've actually just discovered... Well, some scientists have just discovered something about how they're colored. That's counter to the assumption that we had just made and no one had really investigated. So in nature, you get color in two ways. You get it as pigments, so that's when there's a chemical molecule in the thing, in the skin or in the surface, that absorbs some wavelengths of light and reflects others. And so you see the reflected light. You can also have structural color, so that surface has these nanostructures that just reflect some wavelengths of light. And so we had always just assumed these nudibranchs were pigmentary colored because they're matte. They're not shimmery, and usually when you get shimmery, when you get structural color, things are shimmery. So if you think about the tui or the kitadu, when you look at it in the sun and they kind of shimmer, that's because it's structural color. And nudibranchs don't do that. But what these scientists did was they actually used optical and electron microscopies to look at it, and they went, oh, this is structural color. And so using a molecule that we actually, it's also used in our DNA called guanine. This guanine can actually crystallize in certain ways that give you these photonic crystals, so they alter how light's reflected. And so this is structural color, but why is it matte and not shimmery? And what is developed and evolved in the nudibranch is basically, it's like pixels across its outer surface. So you'll get these crystals that reflect the same color of light, so maybe they're all reflecting blue, but they're reflecting it in different directions, and so that's not what, so that's why it doesn't shimmer, it's why it looks matte. And so one of the comparison they made is, you think of an impressionist painting, so Monet and stuff, where they use dots of color next to each other.
My favorites.
Yeah, and that's what the nudibranch's got, right? That's how it's doing it. So it can generate color either by changing this photonic crystal, or it can also have two photonic crystals of different color, so like your blue and red next to each other until you start to see violet. So this is how they do it. And so obviously just finding out this stuff is really cool, but then there are, you know, like, how could you apply this? And you can think, like, if you could replicate that sort of structuring, you could have more sustainable coloring and stuff and materials that we make.
Because they got so many colors. It's crazy.
It's seriously crazy. Like, you just... you can see why people compare them to butterflies, right? Because if you think of butterflies, they end up with these, and they use structural color as well, these amazing sort of shapes, patterns, and yeah, like the pinks and the oranges are just out of this world.
Well, thank you nudibranchs.
Yeah,
and thank you color, I guess.
Yeah, I always like a good color story.
It's a great story. And what do we have last?
So the other one, last one's a little bit of a shift, and still we're looking at how light gets reflected, actually, but about monitoring wound healing. So if you have a large wound in your skin, and it takes a while to heal, so this is not just a slice, this is like when there's a kind of a gap gone, and so the skin takes a while to heal, but monitoring that healing process is actually really hard, because you can't biopsy it. Like a biopsy is when you take some tissue and you test. Not really a smart idea to biopsy something that you're trying to get to grow back in. You can like do repeated imaging using equipment that we have, but that equipment tends to be really expensive. It's oversubscribed. You know, if you try and get imaging in the health system now, it's really hard sometimes, right? And so what tends to happen is it comes down to the doctor or the nurse looking at it and going, yeah, it looks fine, doesn't look infected, it looks like how we would expect, measuring its size to making sure that it's kind of getting smaller as an open wound. Which, you know, obviously we'd like something that's a bit more objective that can tell us what's going on below the skin. And so that's where this study came in. They were using a technique called optical coherence tomography. And basically what this is, if you think about ultrasound imaging, so if you think about when people look at a fetus and stuff, or, you know, maybe they're looking at your knee or whatever, they're using sound to establish an image below the surface. And it's basically sound waves go in, they reflect off different surfaces, and then we can reconstruct an image from that. In optical coherence tomography, instead of using sound, we use light. So what it means is we can't actually go as deep into tissue, but we can get really good detail. And so it gets used a lot for eyes and looking at degeneration in the back of your eye and your retinal diseases and stuff. So some people, if they've been to Specsavers and had their eyes tested, might have had an OCT imaging done.
There's a chance I have.
Yeah, I was looking.
I'm thinking
speak, so,
about it.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
So this, because it's this depth-resolved imaging that's non-invasive, you don't have to break the surface, you can start to look at the structure within the tissue, and that can tell you about how it's healing. You can also start to look at the blood flow, which obviously you want good blood flow for good healing. And that's what the study basically did. They built an OCT system that they could do this, but then they've coupled it with AI, because OCT generates massive amounts of data. You can't look through every image. So using AI, you can start to train it to look for various tissue structures, and then it will go through all the images you've done, and you can start to get something really quantitative, which is really what the brilliance of the study was. So they could basically, they were looking at mice, they would give a little wound to them and then monitor them, and you're looking for something called granulation tissue. So this is basically, you know, when you get smooth sort of glassy tissue that initially fills an area, so kind of that's your granulation tissue. It's really important to start the healing. And so they were able to follow how much of this infiltrated into these wounds. And what they were also doing, it was kind of a two-for-one study. They were looking at different hydrogels. So hydrogels are basically water with a little bit of stuff in it that makes it a gel. And you can use these on like skin wounds and stuff to promote healing. And so they had different types of hydrogel that they were putting on some of these wounds. So they were imaging to see if their imaging technique worked, but also assessing, did these hydrogels make a difference? And what they found is if you had a stiffer sort of hydrogel, so it had a bit more stuff than some other hydrogels, it actually worked a bit better. Like it promoted this granulation tissue kind of infiltrating quicker and more of it. And then they could monitor like blood flow as well. And so there was a more of a transition from, you know, this wound healing sort of tissue to actual just back to your skin sort of thing. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's always great to have a medical breakthrough,
yeah.
Right? Especially, I mean, I would like it if, you know, I could know how my wound healing is going without having to go, ah.
Yeah, and it's going to, like, it's probably going to be even more important. So, you know, diabetes is still on the rise. It might, the rise of diabetes might change in the next few years, but who knows? And one of the kind of complications with that is you get a lot of wounds on feet and stuff, and it can be, you get chronic wounds, like they're really hard to heal and stuff. And so obviously a lot of this work is kind of interested in moving towards that direction and doing imaging in diabetic patients and stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, very interesting. Thank you very much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. STEMVIR is back again at Motet. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations this weekend.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Carhartt Work in Progress has just unleashed Audio Archives,
a collaboration with 17 independent radio stations from around the world, including your faves,
95 BFM.
Audio Archives is a celebration of independent radio and includes a printed publication, a capsule collection, and a global program of radio broadcasts and events.
Check out all the details at carhartt-wip.com and search for Audio Archives.
Strange Universe and 95BFM are pleased as punch to present May Simonis live at the Tuning Fork, Tuesday, June 16th, as part of Strange Universe Winter. May Simonis makes her long-awaited Aotearoa debut and is set to make the city swoon over her sumptuous blend of indie rock, bossa nova, jazz, and chamber pop. Strange Universe Winter featuring May Simonis and so much more. See the stupendous full lineup and get tickets from banishedmusic.com.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Audio. Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories, and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
The original originator.
95.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. This weekend, MOTAT is hosting its STEM Fair. All weekend, hands-on activities and demonstrations will be running in order to provide both education and play to the innovators of tomorrow. Last week, we headed to MOTAT to speak with Head of Brand and Communications at the museum, Samantha Perry, about the STEM Fair and how it fits into MOTAT's wider ethos.
I think a lot of, especially in Auckland, you know, a lot of people have ideas about MOTAT from when they were kids, but what... If anything, what do we want to think about when we think about MOTAT in 2026?
Well, when you think about MOTAT, I think when you think about our audience, it's really diverse, and we are extremely popular with families. For our family audience, it is a real huge play space of science and technology. It's just super exciting. You get to be really hands-on, minds-on, and it's not just a great day out, although that is a huge draw card. It's a great day out, but you are incredibly inspired by small things. You'll see a collection item in operation. You'll see something about the past that you had no idea about, and then you'll see an exhibition where you've got autonomous aircraft and you're looking at the future. So it's just a real mind-blowing discovery time, and all in a really fun environment where it's all about play and learning.
I mean, and you've mentioned it there, but the play, How does, especially looking at maybe a science education space, what role does play kind of play in what MOTAT wants to do?
Yeah, so we've got an idea there called powerful play, because play is so powerful. It's what sparks people's interests and passion. You learn through play. That's such a elementary thing about early childhood education and onward, that when you are playing is the best time to be learning. It's having fun and you don't know what you're doing. You're just absolutely enjoying your time, but that after effect has deep consequences, and you'll be looking at something, wondering how it works, or let's try this, and that's innovation, that's curiosity. So play is so powerful, and so that's why we think MOTAT is the home of powerful play, and we're not just kids, I was saying families here, but adults as well, get to discover, learn and play. And science and technology is our focus area and our key area of expertise, and how our collection actually comes together. It's all innovation technology of its time. It's mind-blowing.
And obviously we're here to talk about the STEM Fair. How does the STEM Fair itself kind of encapsulate all of these ideas of play and powerful play, and kind of just really giving people a space to explore these STEM ideas?
Yeah, well, the event itself over a weekend is fantastic opportunity for our visitors to come and see people who are actually working in the industry. So we've got scientists, engineers, mathematicians, a real range of people demonstrating what they're working on currently, anything from robotics to environmental waste solutions. It's really, really broad, and it's a really exciting day where I'm saying especially kids here, but families, kids, adults, they all get to talk with these people, find out what they're working on, get to share in their passions and interests, and it's equally exciting for the people who are exhibiting. They just get such a buzz out of connecting with the public and sharing their passion as well. And what it does is it helps for people to understand that you can actually, these types of industries, etc., are not just for, it's not just for people who have major qualifications and expertise. Anyone can get into it, and, you know, it all starts with sparking your passion, and by having a go and getting stuck into it, you might actually find that that's something you want to do.
And I kind of, on that, when we're talking about, like, inspiring and across, you know, across all sorts of qualifications. What's sort of the goal for, I think, MOTAT in kind of inspiring a group of younger people, both who might be going into STEM careers and who actually just might not be, but still want to learn something?
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot about STEM, but it's actually regardless of what you do. It's actually about how you grow as a person. So that sense of curiosity and discovery is gold, and you might work as an artist, is still going to get something here at MOTAT. We actually talk about STEAM instead of STEM, and that's science, technology, engineering, arts and maths. And we also like to add another M for Mātauranga Māori, and very much looking at a te ao Māori perspective as well, which we have so much to learn from in Aotearoa New Zealand. I forgot your question.
Just kind of what, when we look at inspiring these kids across these spaces, kind of how does that change, or how does that stay the same between the people who might be going into, I mean, more traditional STEM fields and maybe these other fields that we've just included there?
Well, I also think there's no need to get binary about STEM or arts, because there is so much crossover. As you were just playing in the kiosk before, you've seen the beauty of maths with fractals and tessellation. You made your amazing display that you sent down onto the floor projection, and, you know, art, nature, maths, it all fits together so beautifully. So it doesn't matter, like, you don't need to actually think, I'm going to be a scientist or engineer, but what you do involves these concepts. Probably in any day that you're doing something, you are using STEM principles just to make a cup of coffee or to do the laundry or navigate how you're going to get from A to B. So it's STEM is everywhere, it's part of everyday life, so let's not make it too intimidating, and let's understand that it's not just for a certain type of person either, because I think it's really common to think you're either creative or academic, or it's actually a mixture, and you can, you know, you can be a data excited hungry ballerina, you know, you know, you might actually use that data to look at how you can improve, how you might be able to warm up more efficiently, how you might be able to cover floor space more economically and with in time with the music. So I mean, I'm just grasping here with my low knowledge, but it is true, you just are using these ideas in everything you do.
And I think, especially going back to, obviously, the inclusion of the arts and also Mātauranga Māori, Motet has, suddenly from when, you know, I was coming as a kid, it's changed a lot in kind of the bringing a lot of the education to kind of the forefront. How might Motet continue to kind of change the way that it approaches education to kind of include, or to further include those kinds of wide-ranging disciplines?
Yeah, absolutely. We're on a journey, and we take a lot of delight and pride in pushing the boundaries about how we can explain the world around us, science, technology, in different ways. Being in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we have such a rich resource to draw on to help us understand the world around us. Te Pua Wānanga, the Science and Technology Centre here at MOTAT, was very much built around having Te Ao Māori as a teacher, as a guide about how science and technology can be understood. And we really hope that people, when they come here, they can see that this is very much a feel real sense of place that they are in Aotearoa, New Zealand. They're not in a London Science and Technology Centre or anywhere else. They're uniquely within a New Zealand context.
Kind of thinking about the STEM Fair coming up and on that, when it comes to encouraging kids to play and to learn through play, why should they come to MOTAT for that?
Yeah, well, talking about the STEM Fair specifically, but it actually, yeah, probably reaches into usual viz as well, but with the STEM Fair, you are going to see such a range of different ways that STEM, science, technology, engineering and maths and arts and Mātauranga Māori is being used in industry, in careers, in innovation. You're going to see lots of departments from universities, and you know, anything from robotics to sea water quality. You will be able to talk to engineers who work in engineering companies, and they have one great little thing is this bridge building exercise. So that's going to be really cool. You'll let off rockets and dancing robots, all sorts of things. So, but it's not just those things you're going to see. You're going to talk to people, get to ask questions, get up close to the people who have had these amazing careers just in STEM, and see that it's possible for anyone. And I just want kids to really think that the possibilities that are out there and how they might apply this into something they do. And we're not looking for people who are going to be solving the biggest problems only. Small and big problems, anything that they think they can solve, they can take a STEM or STEAM or STEAM application to, and it's a wide world out there for them. MOTAT is the science and technology playground of Aotearoa. We firmly believe that. Play's not a dirty word. Play is such a great thing. Come, enjoy, play, experiment, get curious, discover, and have a great day as well. Yeah.
That was Samantha Perry, Head of Brand and Communications at MOTAT, on the museum's STEM Fair and how it reflects MOTAT.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
A large part of the focus in New Zealand over the last week or so has been on fuel prices. As conflict and strikes continue in the wake of US and Israel's moves on Iran, the ramifications of restricted movement through the Strait of Hormuz has been felt globally, and New Zealand is no different. Rising fuel prices have rapidly put pressure on New Zealand households already struggling with cost of living, leading to a tense economic situation. While the government is looking to provide what they call targeted assistance, there remains uncertainty on how they will support New Zealanders through a potential fuel crisis. This week, I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about this assistance, as well as the wider context of fuel woes in Iran and the cost of living crisis. I just want to point to recent negative polling for National. Specifically, though, I want to point to the fact that Christopher Luxon has said in defense of polling numbers that people don't care about polls, they want to see the economy get better. In terms of the state of the economy, how do these claims kind of sit in the midst of this ongoing fuel crisis?
Well, obviously, I mean, it's a challenging environment for everyone. I mean, our position is, you know, thank goodness we've been so focused on getting, you know, government debt down, domestic inflation down, and trying to build up some resilience in our coffers for this sort of circumstance. I mean, even forecasts were starting to say we were starting to return to surplus, and things were looking optimistic. This does obviously put a bit of a stress into that system, but at least we were controlling the factors we can control. Obviously, every country around the world is going to be impacted by this to a greater or lesser extent.
And in terms of those impacts, what, as the government sees it, is the current kind of impact on New Zealand and New Zealanders around fuel?
Well, obviously, it affects everyone, and, you know, right through from the plastics industry to transport, and, of course, you know, mum and dad's dropping kids off at school. So it has a real huge implication of, you know, first order and then second and third order implications as well, right through business, even hospitality. If people start to not go out as much, that'll obviously have an impact on hospitality and CBD and retail. And obviously there's a cascading effect. So the biggest thing we can do is to try and find or try and build that buffer, which you've seen a lot of stuff come out in terms of making sure our supplies are stopped. And obviously there's, you know, an official group set up to monitor that a couple of times a week, just to make sure that we're looking at all sorts of options around, you know, diversifying that supply where we can. But yeah, obviously Australia's going through a similar thing as well, so It's certainly not unique to us.
And the government is set to announce their kind of fuel support package later today. What can we expect to see kind of in the ethos of this package and kind of the vague support that it's going to offer New Zealanders?
Well, I think the key is that we know that the cost of fuel is one of the most significant in terms of hitting lower socioeconomics, those with less discretionary income. So the Minister of Finance has been very clear, as has the PM, that we want to be targeted with it. We don't want to take a carte blanche approach where people that have got more resilience in their discretionary income to absorb it. We want to be really targeted, because obviously we haven't got, as a government, money to throw around. We've got to be very careful what we embed. So it's obviously got to be temporary. And timely as well. So we don't want it to go on the never-never. It's got to be, you know, those three things have got to be very specifically worked through so that we help those that need it the most while this is at its peak.
But looking at that, since we don't really, we can't possibly know the sort of scope in terms of timeline of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East, so how does the government expect to kind of be able to continue to support New Zealanders if this crisis turns out to be prolonged?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a valid question. I think the key is obviously we've got to make sure that we're targeting the people that need it most, because obviously if there's a fiscal implication, we want to be making sure that it's going to those people that need it most, so that's, you know, targeted and timely, which means very soon. But yeah, I mean, the temporary piece, obviously we don't know how long, what the longevity of this will be. Even if it is relatively short you know, the implications of what's already gone down, we understand could impact, you know, shipping and logistics and still have a long tail on it. So it's going to very much be a watch and see. It's going to be quite a dynamic position. We'll have to just keep that active watch on and respond accordingly.
And looking elsewhere from the kind of support and to maybe alternative means of transport for New Zealanders, can we expect to see any action from the government around either electric vehicles or encouraging the use of public transport?
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as public transport, we've already seen surges in that, which is great. That's always been, you know, one of the challenges for New Zealand is, you know, public transport is heavily subsidised, and so actually to see the uptake on it actually really is a positive thing. And I guess it exposes people to alternative routes and alternative modes of transport that they might not have, you know, ultimately considered. So that's a positive thing. In terms of, you know, targeting EVs or subsidies, would be probably slow to move into something in that space because, you know, when the last administration, you know, did EV subsidies effectively, you know, we would joke that the wealthy people were getting discounts on Teslas and, you know, again, it wasn't targeted, so we've got to be very careful. And the other thing with EVs and that sort of thing, you know, that's a large-scale purchase for your average family, and so those things can take, you know, months or years to translate. So if we're making any moves in that space, we've got to do it very carefully. Obviously, just last week we announced increase in EV charges around the country, which was part of the policy that we campaigned on. That goes a long way to supporting the use of EVs and logistics and taking away some of that range anxiety, which is a real thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think you'll see a multi-pronged approach where we've got to do temporary targeted and timely relief for those that need it most now, and then we'll also have to look at what are the things in the medium term around public transport, electrification of, you know, fleets and vehicles and those sorts of things, but they're more of a medium long-term translation.
I mean, and I just want to go back to the talking about the public transport surges. Is there anything that we can expect to see in kind of trying to encourage these surges to maybe stay? Because if this high demand is positive, does the government have plans to kind of continue to support a higher base for public transport?
Yeah, again, I think we'll have to just wait and see. Like, it'll be unique to different regions. Obviously, where you've got your concentrations around cities like Auckland and Wellington and Christchurch, some of them have better public transport systems or more optionality around trains and buses. And so, you know, tweaks around, you know, those formulas might be easier, but we've got to be careful that we don't, you know, do something that we can't undo. And obviously there's a lot of overlay too with central government. A lot of them are controlled through regional councils or urban councils, and so it's not actually, in many cases, a direct government control that we can pull. So I think there's going to be, you know, a lot of integration in terms of talking with local and central government, regional councils. But we've got to understand the data, the evidence, so that we can make, you know, really informed and targeted decisions in those nuanced areas.
And just kind of finally on this, New Zealand has been quick to condemn and point to Iran strikes around the Strait of Hormuz and the surrounding area for kind of the linchpin of this whole crisis. But looking at what is an escalating conflict, does the government kind of acknowledge the role that the other parties in this conflict, like the US and Iran, have on the fuel prices also?
Oh, I mean, of course we acknowledge. I mean, a lot of that is obviously beyond our control. You know, we've signed that agreement just over a week ago, the government did, to try and obviously, you know, condemning the Iran and the controlling of that strait, because it's the implications are huge for the rest of the world. So where we can, we're working with our, you know, allied countries to form agreements and partnerships. We've got to be careful not to criticise when we don't have all the facts, and obviously the move that the states did, as our PM has said, we haven't been privy to the information that they used to act on that. So I think we have to be very careful to criticise, but certainly, we're very conscious of you know, these plays, and we've got to find out. We've got to not be afraid to stand up, but we've also got to remember that as an isolated country of 5 million, we're very dependent on good international relations as well.
And just with that, what is the government's official stance on the conflict?
Well, obviously, we'd like to see it end as quickly as possible. You know, we're a big believer in international rules. We're seeing that that position be challenged now throughout the world. And we hold firm to those values. We want to see, you know, preservation of human life as our most importance. But we've got rules we'll need to abide by. And yeah, like I said, we've just got to enter these things very carefully, and look after the welfare of New Zealand and also our Pacific neighbours.
And just circling back to discussions of support in terms of the financial assistance that Finance Minister Nicola Willis has been announcing and talking about, she kind of pointed to the idea of the fuel prices as a household squeeze in the context of, you know, the wider cost of living crisis. But why is this the first really targeted official support that we've seen for this household squeeze?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it is. I mean, we know that the big contributors to domestic inflation are insurance, council rates, and we've targeted councils in terms of legislation, which we're actually moving through the House in terms of rates caps, and we've sent a message out to councils. You know, we've removed wellbeings from the budget. We're saying, actually, we want you to get back to core business. And so we have targeted some of those other drivers of domestic inflation. We've looked at what we can do in the supermarket space because food's another huge contributor. We've amended fast-track legislation to make it easier for other supermarket players to come into the market to alleviate competition. But obviously some of those are, you know, sort of medium-term things that take a while to flow through. This is dramatic. You know, it's nearly a dollar increase over 3 weeks or something. So that's, you know, on the, you know, in terms of petrol bills for households, that's a huge jump. And so that's why we're coming after this quite quickly and quite targeted.
But if this crisis either continues or, you know, cost of living continues to be an issue, can we expect to see any sort of issue when it comes to supporting households in terms of maybe looking at rent or welfare?
Well, I think those, you know, rent and welfare are already, you know, issues that we address through, you know, MSD and its various allocations. And this is specifically a petrol-related crisis, so we're targeting that one specifically.
That was the National Party's MP, Ryan Hamilton, talking about rising fuel prices and the government's plans to assist New Zealanders through a fuel-related crisis.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
The Wire.
Kia ora. The war between the US-Israeli coalition and Iran has entered its fourth week, with an immediate end to the conflict remaining out of sight. The war has caused casualties throughout the Middle East and has significantly affected the global economy, with fuel prices soaring worldwide. I spoke with Professor Richard Jackson, leading thinker, chair in peace and conflict studies, and co-director of Te Ao o Rongomadairoa, the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago, about chances for peace, the widespread effects on the region, and the meaning of the conflict for the international rules-based order. First of all, kia ora, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us today. Before we start, would you mind giving me your name and title so I know how to address you?
So I'm Professor Richard Jackson from Te Ao o Rongomadairoa, the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago.
So obviously today we will be talking about the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Just in the last 48 hours, US President Donald Trump had recently regressed on hitting more Iranian fuel depots due to apparent diplomatic successes. Are these grounds for optimism, and what hopes do you have for an end to the conflict?
I think we have to be very cautious about an end to the conflict at this stage, because the major players in this all have strong kind of interests in continuing the conflict. And they've also backed themselves into a corner, particularly in terms of the rhetoric that they expressed about why they were conducting this war. So I think, for example, without any major concessions or without any major achievements that the Trump administration kind of said were the reasons for going to war, it would be hard for them to stop now. And at the same time, Israel has very strong interests, particularly the Netanyahu government, in continuing the conflict. Netanyahu is facing a lot of domestic issues back home. The war provides a very useful distraction from those and allows him to continue in power as a war president without having to face those domestic issues. So I think the odds of trying to resolve this are tricky. On the Iranian side, the fact that their leader was killed, they were attacked while they were negotiating, civilians were killed in the school bombing, and they're facing a lot of destruction, means that they have very few interests in surrendering or giving up. They want to assert their sovereignty and assert their power. So their interest is continuing to hurt the global economy in response to this attack. So I think all three sides have very strong incentives to continue this conflict, unfortunately.
I guess the US-Israeli goals within this conflict seem to, the strategic goals seem to be changing week for week. At first, the elimination of the Ayatollah was the main goal, and I guess they were suspecting that regime change would take place by itself afterwards. Then, on the other hand, potential nuclear weapons were also used as an explanation. Do you believe that regime change is the ultimate goal that will appease the US-Israeli attacks?
So I think we have to be careful here in differentiating between the Israeli goals and the Trump administration goals. There's some evidence that Trump was kind of talked into this war by Israel, and Israel's goals are a lot different to the US, I think. Israel's goals involve making sure that there are no countries in the region that have the capacity to pose a threat to what Israel wants to do. So for them, what happened to Iraq would be ideally what happens to Iran and to Syria as well. So, I mean, they are hoping not necessarily for a regime change, but for a regime collapse, for, you know, infighting to occur, for civil war, for instability, for anything that will make the regime really unstable and have to focus on internal issues and become weaker so that it can't pose any kind of threat to Israel or to the US interest. The United States, on the other hand, I don't think they really have a clear idea of what their goals were. I think they were talked into this. They were probably convinced that because of the previous uprisings, nonviolent uprisings by Iranians protesting about various issues in the past, that the regime was ready to collapse. But anyone who knows anything about the Middle East knows that that was simply not the case. The Iranian regime is very robust and powerful. It has a very strong organization, and it's not going to collapse simply because other countries bomb it. And to be honest, there's no examples from history either, despite hundreds of cases where external powers have bombed a country and then that has led to a regime change. So no serious analyst thinks that is the real goal there. And on the question of nuclear weapons, I mean, there's no evidence whatsoever that Iran was getting close. I think they were in the middle of negotiating a deal when they were attacked. That deal would have probably taken them back to the deal they had previously, where they didn't have sanctions put on them, but they allowed inspectors to make sure that they didn't enrich their uranium beyond a certain low-level point. It's not in their interests, I don't think, to provoke this kind of attack by rapidly developing nuclear weapons. However, I think because of this attack, they may now feel that having nuclear weapons might have protected them. So that may be an incentive to them in the future to develop nuclear weapons. So again, the aims of this conflict have not been thought through, and they are not very, very clear at all.
Obviously, the situations in Iraq and Syria, I guess forms of ongoing civil wars, conflicts that lasted up to 10 years or even longer. And regarding the being talked into it, Israel had planned the strikes on Iran and then essentially contacted the US saying, you're either with us or not. They kind of had to join in an already planned attack. And then obviously the nuclear weapon, the potential development as a nuclear weapon, as a deterrent that these strikes would not occur in the future if Iran did actually possess a nuclear weapon. And so regardless of how long the war continues, how do you think the scale of violence and destruction that we've seen so far will affect the Middle East in the long term?
I think it will have a long-lasting effect. It is just such a tragedy for the Middle East. The Middle East continues to be the most intervened region in the world, with outside powers pouring weapons in, but also engaging in a series of wars, each of which has led to complete disaster. I mean, to me, it's, you know, a kind of perfect example of that saying, which is that insanity is continuing to do the same thing over and over again, but expecting a different result. I mean, Western powers have intervened not just in Iran, but in, you know, in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere across the Middle East, decade after decade, and it has always just increased the misery. It's always just increased the destruction. These wars are going to displace a lot of people. They're going to put back economic development. They're going to harm international trade. They're going to lead to greater insecurity. More weapons will pour into the area. And all of these things will make it much, much worse. And it won't bring security. It won't bring security for Israel. It won't bring security for all the U.S. military bases over there. It won't bring security for energy supply routes. This is an unmitigated disaster. And we really have to ask, you know, who's making these decisions and why are they making such bad decisions? And is there anything that the rest of the world can do? And it surprises me that the New Zealand government is sort of just quietly going along with all this when the outcomes are clearly not going to be in New Zealand's interest and not in the interests of a secure and stable and peaceful international system.
Not only New Zealand, but obviously a lot of other traditional allies to the US and also Israel, such as the UK or members of the European Union. Everyone has universally criticized the Iranian responses to the US and Israeli strikes, but very few have openly criticized the strikes themselves, the so-called preemptive strikes. Do you think that the international community should have acted stronger in condemning the actions of the US-Israeli coalition?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the whole world should have united and condemned both the United States and Israel for this, for putting the global economy at risk and for destabilizing everything. And they should do so now. I mean, the quickest and simplest way to resolve all this is for the United States and Israel to stop their attack. They have hammered Iran. I don't think it's, you know, going to have the kind of offensive capability that it used to have anymore. And why would it want to do that anymore? I think it just wants an end to this conflict. Every time Iran has attacked, you know, energy supplies or military bases or anything in the middle, in that region, it's done so in direct response to attacks by Israel and the United States. So if Israel and the United States stopped right now, then we could probably resolve this. And I think that's where the pressure has to go. I mean, it seems ridiculous to me to be blaming Iran. Iran was in the middle of good faith negotiations when they got attacked. We should just stop this attack and go back to those negotiations, which Iran was taking seriously. And to blame them for defending themselves to the best way that they can seems completely misplaced to me. But I think the problem is that everyone's afraid of Donald Trump and the United States. He's so unpredictable and in many ways quite irrational in the things that he does. And I think no one wants to provoke him more or, you know, to have him invade Greenland or some other crazy thing like that. So they're still playing carefully with him. They're still moderating what their criticism. And I think that's a mistake, because I think a united front against him would actually perhaps cause him to change course and rethink his strategy, particularly in this issue.
Yeah, sadly, that's all the time we have. But thank you so much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
That was the University of Otago's Richard Jackson on the US-Israeli war in Iran and potential for resolution.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ira te hō taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai, au mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on to the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Dr. Kushla McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Motat Samantha Perry, and the University of Otago's Professor Richard Jackson. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to the 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.